and welcome back to another episode of Your Pocket Nurse, a podcast for student and graduate nurses. I would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people as the original owners of the land on which I am recording on today. I pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging. Hello and welcome to another episode of Your Pocket Nurse. Today I'm joined by Danny, an Australian nurse but is working in the UK. So we're going to chat all about the process of it all and differences in healthcare and all about PACU nursing as well. So hello.
Hello.
Thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
How are you going?
I am good. It is currently 9:20 over here in the UK at night, and I've just finished a 12-hour shift. So that is the current vibe.
Well, thank you for joining me after a 12-hour shift. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
So usually I start off with three questions that I ask everyone, just so we can sort of get to know everyone. But why did you become a nurse? And if you weren't a nurse, what job do you think you'd have?
So I started my sort of what do I want to be when I grow up, the serious conversation version, when I was in high school wanting to do medicine.
Mm-hmm.
I watched too much House and ER in high school, and I thought that looked cool, and I loved reading medical textbooks and science. And then when I was in year 11 and 12, I had a really hard time with anxiety and what would turn out to be endometriosis. And my teachers were just absolutely fantastic in helping me get through it and supporting me. And I decided that I wanted to be just like them and be a teacher. So I went off to university to do English literature and criminology so that I could be a teacher. I really loved that degree. I won't lie. It was awesome. But there was something kind of missing in it that I guess I'd sort of loved in medicine, and that idea of wanting to help people and do clinical things. And I remember sitting with the nursing students one day in the library because there was nowhere else to sit, like standard uni stuff. Mm-hmm. And they just looked like they were having the best time doing their case studies. And I was really interested in what they were talking about. And I thought, maybe this is coming back to the first thing I think I ever wanted to be, which was a nurse.
Mm-hmm.
And before I really understood what it meant to be one, maybe that was, you know, what I wanted. And so I looked into applying to nursing school, and I found the graduate entry masters at the University of Queensland. So I finished my other degree because I didn't want to be one of those people that left their degrees unfinished and just had a lot of hex debt. I wanted, if I was going to pay for it, I wanted something to show for it. And it's actually very much helped in other parts of my career. I get to actually say now that I have a Bachelor of Arts, and I can say I'm a criminologist, even though it's a skill that I can't really use anywhere else. Technically I am one, which is cool to say at parties. The way I did that was really good because the master's meant that I was with other people that had done their other degrees first. I didn't feel like, you know, the oldest kid in the class. I was actually the youngest. I was 20 when I started my master's. The next youngest person was 25. So I was like, okay, I'm the baby of the group. Cool. But I was often the oldest grad. The perfect blend for me of teaching and medicine. And now that I am a nurse and I look at how rough we work, the junior doctors, I absolutely know because you have to work so much to get through everything we throw at juniors. And I feel like they don't get to spend as much time with the patients as I do. It takes them a really long time to get to a place where they can spend that one-on-one time with patients. And I think I'm not patient enough for it. I am.
No.
And after my endometriosis, I would have felt so much pressure to go for obs and gynae and to go do the excision specialist fellowship, which would be like, if I'd done that, I would only be just starting to be a reg now.
And that's just unthinkable to me. And I absolutely admire people that do go out there for it. And I follow a lot of junior doctors on social media, and I love reading about all their stories. But there are some days that they describe and I go, yikes, I am so glad that I'm on my side, because I love what I do and respect the hell out of what they do. But yeah, that's not what I want.
Yeah, I agree with that. Because I also once thought about medicine, but it's just, for me, it's like the fact that, yeah, you study for so long and like you do need to have a real passion for it. And I do think it needs to be like your number one priority in life. You know, I was looking, like, I also follow some doctors on my Instagram, and, you know, yesterday I was looking at a story and it was like, you know, what's her routine? She wakes up, you know, early in the morning to go to the gym, then she studies before lectures, then she goes for lectures, tutorials, then she'll study more, then she'll have dinner, she'll study more. And I was like, you know, I don't think I can like dedicate my life just to studying, you know. And I think, like, I suppose, you know, other people obviously do, especially females, but like for me, you know, I really want to have children and, you know, like all of that business. And I feel like it would be really difficult to juggle all that. And obviously people do it, but I just know for me, like, I would not be able to do that. And there's that aspect of responsibility as well. Like, you know, I think, oh wow, I have so much responsibility as a nurse, but then I'll never forget this one night shift, like this, you know, because they're all residents covering night shifts, you know, and they're covering multiple specialties that, you know, maybe like they don't know 100% about, you know, if they haven't rotated through there properly. And like, they're constantly getting messages like, can you please rapid review this patient? Can you please chart this? Can you do this? Can you do this? And this doctor, I could just see her. She was getting so overwhelmed. And I was like,
oh, absolutely.
I'm just going to sit here and look at my five patients that I've got for the night, because that was a really nice ward that only has a 1-to-5 ratio overnight. And I was like, oh, bless. Mind my own business. But yeah, it's just, it's a lot. And I think you do need to be like 100% in it to get through it.
Absolutely. And it's, I think part of, it's like part of growing up is realizing the actual reality of what working in healthcare is, and that it's not like television at all. And, you know, the reality of being a doctor and a nurse is so different. And the understanding what it actually is, it, what it means to be a nurse, I think it stops you having that thing that you go, oh, that if I'm not a doctor, maybe I'm not as good, or it's because I couldn't handle it. It's like, oh no, they're two completely different jobs and two completely different parts of the healthcare team. And we couldn't exist without each other. And I think sometimes that's what we all have to remember about ourselves as well, is that no, we're not in some hierarchy here. We're all different members on the same team.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's so important, you know, because I think, like, sometimes I've gotten questions like, oh, how do you approach doctors and things like that? And I think, well, just like a normal person, you know, like, you're allowed like to, like, you know, like, just because they're a doctor does not mean that they necessarily are more important than us as nurses. I think that, you know, as like a grad, like, I was a bit nervous at the start, like messaging doctors and, you know, asking them to do things for me. But now I'm so comfortable. Like, you know, so I used to be like, can you maybe chart like on dance because my patient's nauseous? Like, now I'm like, can you chart on dance, please? Because, you know, patient is about to throw up. So, you know, I think like you sort of change your attitude and realize that, you know, they value, you know, you coming to them and saying like, can you please do this because the patient is, you know, blah, blah. Their magnesium is this, can you maybe chart some replacement, instead of just, you know, feeling like, oh, we can't suggest things to them because like we're not doctors.
Yeah, I can 100% tell that you work in cardiac, because I used to work in CCU, and it would just be me going to remind the juniors, have you charted the potassium and the magnesium, because I really need it. It was absolutely me going to remind them, and by the time they got to the end of their rotation, they'd be like, Danny, I charted the potassium without you asking me. And I'd be like, oh, mom is proud.
Yeah, no, that's really good. So you're currently working in PACU, but do you think this is the area you eventually want to work in, or is there somewhere else you want to explore?
Look, I will never say never to another specialty, but PACU is absolutely the best job I've ever had. I started my career as a pool nurse. So I literally worked on
every ward there is. So I've had a good sampling of it.
Yeah.
And warden, I always knew ward nursing wasn't 100% for me. I didn't hate it, but I wasn't hard and fast in love with it. And mm-hmm. I'd always wanted to be a theatre nurse. So the opportunity to work in theatre over here and then eventually in PACU, it's better than I ever thought it could have been. And I don't know if it's just because of the team I'm in and the trust that I'm in, but yeah, it's really where I see myself long term as a specialist in Wonderful. This particular. I do like the idea, but of course, over here in the UK, a lot of us got redeployed to critical care during the first wave of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
We got a very different experience. And for a lot of us, it wasn't necessarily what we were putting our hands up to say, yes, I'm very excited about this. It was like, mm-hmm. it's critical care, but not as you know it. Before yeah. COVID, I would have been 100% down for doing a critical care rotation just to learn some of those assessment skills and see the other side of things. I know a lot of people I went to school with, they were very much, they wanted to do emergency or ICU. I was one of the only ones that was really into theatre, but I was never that person. I remember walking into the ICU once as a student and being terrified and going, oh my god, there's like 10 pumps on that pole, what's going on, get me out of here. That patient's family is staring at me like I'm being really disrespectful for being in their space. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna leave now. But obviously, once now that I'm qualified and I think I've gotten a bit more comfortable with the critical care aspects of PACU, because we do cross over mm-hmm. quite a bit. We sort of stop, our ceiling of care is ventilation, so we don't do that in mm-hmm. our recovery. There are recoveries in the NHS that do that, and certainly in the United States as well. It's not typically done so much in Australia in my experience, but again, that's just my experience in Queensland. But yeah, you do get the chance, you get everything from, you know, the day cases to stuff that's going to the highest level in ICU. So yeah, I kind of feel like I get a bit of the critical care stuff without having to actually be a critical care nurse.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, it's interesting because, yeah, like specialties do cross over. You know, people, you know, can crash and something might need to happen, or, you know, they come out of theatre and have all the pumps going and things like that, and then you're dealing with that when until they go to the ward or ICU or whatever.
Mm.
Yeah. And what has been your favourite clinical experience or moment, whether it be on a placement or at work so far?
That's one of those tough ones that I have been having a think about. I think for me, it's actually happened quite recently. I have a lot of favorite clinical moments from back home, like really nice stuff with patients. But for me, a few months ago, I was working in one of our satellite recoveries, which is like a recovery away from the main one on a different floor, because we're a very big hospital that has a lot of different surgical floors. Mm-hmm. And I was with one of our senior nurses, and it was just him and I working through this particular list. And we had a very poorly patient who became unwell very quickly, and we sort of had to, you know, work very quickly to stabilize them. And he's got years of experience on me, both in recovery and as a nurse in general, that he came over to me to ask me what my opinion was about his patient. He said, can you go and have a look? Can you do the assessment and tell me what you think? And it was just, you know, it was a kind of stressy, chaotic situation, but we were still such a good team and we worked so well together. And knowing that he valued my opinion was just something that sort of stayed with me.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, when you're new and newly qualified, you sort of think, oh my god, I'm never going to be one of those cool nurses that I admire that, you know, knows everything, even though they don't know everything, you just think they do. But yeah, it was one of those moments where it's like, have I arrived? Have I moved, unlocked a new nursing skill? Am I one of those nurses now? And yeah, it's great teamwork and great to
kind of get that feedback that, you know, your opinion is valued, and that the people that you work with, it doesn't matter that they're more senior than you, they recognize that maybe you could see something that they don't.
Yeah, I love that, because like sometimes people pick like a really like, you know, big moment, like, oh, like I delivered this baby and blah blah blah,
but oh god, it's like, keep me away from babies.
But like often it's like those little things, it's just like, you know, feeling, yeah, like you said, valued, and like someone, you know, sort of trusts your experience and knowledge. And I think, you know, I can't wait for that time, because I know I'm not there yet, obviously, but it's like, you know, it'd be so nice to experience that and feel like, you know, I've got this, you know.
It does. And that moment does come for everybody, even if you think it's never going to. I always thought it never would. I was like, oh, no, I'm not. Maybe, like, I'm a good nurse, but maybe I'm not fantastic. It's because, you know, everyone's got that self-doubt. But
yeah.
No, I am lucky to work with some really incredible people that will 100% challenge your own insecurities and anxieties by, you know, telling you that no, you're really good and we want to keep you. And not just because we're very short staffed, we do like you.
That's the best compliment, I think. So going back to Australia, can you tell us a bit about your grad year? As you said, it was in Poole, and maybe any like hot tips for new nurses as well. I remember I actually messaged you when I started my Poole rotation, and you gave me some great advice and relaxed me a bit more. Yeah, that's going back months ago now.
Yes, it's one of those things. I've loved watching like some of the grad or student nurses that I followed on Instagram become like these grown-up nurses, and I'm just like, oh, so proud. It's a good moment. Yes, I did Poole for my grad year. So I think a lot of us in Australia know this, particularly in Queensland, but I know in other areas as well. Grad year applications are brutal. Trying to get a job is brutal. And my year in particular, I know the state health department spend a lot of money on a very much needed digital hospital upgrade. And so money for things like student nurses becoming grads was a little bit sparse. And so a lot of areas cut down the amount of grads that they were taking. Mm-hmm. It was an election year as well, so there was a hiring freeze for a while. I came out of placement in my final year knowing that I wanted to be a theatre nurse. I had a fantastic placement in the hospital that I'd done all of my placements at. I was encouraged by basically everyone that I talked to there to apply for the grad program. But theatre, ICU and ED are the three most competitive grad programs.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to, in Queensland, we have a very odd preferencing system where you have to go two hospitals to preference and then three specialties within that hospital. It's a whole production. And basically, if you pick something as your first preference and don't, there's a good chance whatever you've put as your second preference, someone else has put as their first. And so you kind of start going down the list then, hoping for an area that maybe wasn't so popular. It's a very strategic application, which mm-hmm. I find a little bit annoying. I much mm-hmm. prefer I applied for the match in Victoria as well. But I was willing to go anywhere. I just wanted a job. But being an interstate student, you get bumped right to the bottom of the list because every state preferences their own graduates first, which is fair enough. If you're from mm-hmm. there, you get that preference. So yes, I did job interviews in Cairns. I went to Tasmania, to some suburb in Western Sydney that I've never been to, but apparently was willing to move to, just to try and get like every theatre program in the country. I applied for it. Even though in the end I ended up getting two grad offers, even though I thought I would never get any, I didn't get my, you know, my dream job in theatre the first time around. And I started doing all these interviews and getting knocked back and thinking that I would never, ever get a job, because I think all of us have thought that at least once during grad year.
Mm-hmm. Yep, definitely.
Eventually I got an offer from Permanent Nurse Pool in the hospital where I had done all my placements. So it was a hospital that I was very comfortable with. It's a very big tertiary hospital in Queensland that was has got a very good reputation. And then I got a graduate program in Canberra in a private hospital in perioperative. And it was a really tough decision to turn down that grad program in Canberra because it was in theatre and that was what I'd always mm-hmm. wanted. But it was like, it's a small hospital. It would mean moving away. I laugh at it now, but it was like, it would mean moving away from my family. It's like, yeah to Canberra. Also, I don't know about you. I'm sorry, anyone from Canberra, but it's not the most exciting place I've ever been.
No.
I mean, I don't drive, so getting around on public transport would be like a whole thing. The rent was really expensive when I looked into it, and I'm just like, oh, it thinks an awful lot of itself for a city that basically exists so our politicians have somewhere to go. Yeah. The education team that interviewed me for that role, they were the most lovely, understanding people in the entire world. When I turned down the job for the one in Queensland, they said, we completely understand. We think that's a really great, that shows a lot of maturity on your part. Good luck. So I took the job in nurse pool, and it 100% wasn't my first preference. Like, I didn't want to be a ward nurse. I remember seeing the pool nurses when I was on placement and thinking, wow, that looks scary, going to a different ward every single day. Why would I do that as a grad? That sounds a bit dangerous. But then the nurse unit manager, he was so encouraging, and he had great clinical facilitators and educators that basically said, don't worry, we're not going to leave you on your own. And there was still a rotation built into it. And he really sold it to us in that he knew that a lot of us were there because we had no other job offers, because he got all the job offers, like all the applications from people that hadn't gotten jobs, so that he could find great people that maybe had been missed. And it was still, he hired every month, so there was a lot of chances, but still 70 people applied my month and only 17 of us got it. So it was still really quite competitive. And so he said to us, don't worry, it's not like anyone that walks through the door gets a job. I'm still tough. I still, you know, try and get you in there. And it was very structured, and he program is a 6 month one where you get a core set of competencies rather than, you know, when you go into a specialist ward, you get a competency book that's super thick and very specific. He said, no, I want you to have a core set of nursing skills that you can take to any ward in this hospital and feel confident. So things, he's like, I want you to get signed off on basic things like giving handover and doing a skin check. And then you can go on to stuff like catheters and all of that business. And, you know, as kind of like a reward for that, we got to do the fun skills a bit earlier than other grads. Like after 6 months in our program, you could go do your cannulation competency. You could go do your PICC line stuff. And so, yeah, I got to cannulate when I was 7 months qualified, whereas all my colleagues on the ward were waiting 12 and 14 months. So
that's,
I felt
me
a bit,
as well.
Yeah. Also, because cool, when you're a pool nurse, so, and you go everywhere, it's like, it's a really valuable skill, and they ask you back, like, especially if you go on shifts in ED, they go, can you cannulate? Yes, you can come back. That's fine. And I learned to cannulate the week that I was in oncology. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, that's why I always, when people go to me, oh, I have really difficult veins, I'm just like, yeah, I learned to cannulate in oncology. Give me, show me. I'll get it. I think I went to radiology the next day, and everybody needed one. So I was just going there, going along, practicing, just getting little blue ones in all the time. It was so much fun. And yeah, it means that I got to work on a lot of different wards, medical, surgical. I worked in rehab, in mental health. That was a terrifying time. The first time I went there, I thought, I'm not a mental health nurse. Surely I cannot do this. But again, staff were like really supportive. They were just grateful to have someone to help, because it's like, we're short staffed and you've sent us a pool nurse. That means that, you know, we've got the support we need to make this staffed shift. And I found that was a really good attitude that we got most of the time. And if it wasn't, our nurse unit manager was really you told him that, you know, the vibe was a bit off, and he'd be like, right, I'll talk to them. And then suddenly it wasn't a problem again.
Yeah.
He was a real presence in our hospital. So I think that helped.
I graduated from my graduate program after 6 months, got a permanent job in Poole,
and it felt like, you know, I graduated nursing school feeling a bit like I didn't know anything, or that maybe I wasn't that good because I didn't have a very good preceptor in a couple of my placements that mm-hmm. made me feel a bit like, you know, I was just annoying them. But we did very long placements, so I got to feel that way for 12 weeks straight, which mm-hmm. was really great. Cool. And so I had to do a lot of unlearning about the things that person projected onto me that weren't about me. They're about their own insecurities and stress and workload. And Poole kind of helped me do that, because you just had to turn up every day and be ready for anything and adapt mm-hmm. to anything. And yeah, it helped with my confidence. It helped with, you know, critical thinking, because you had to have that, yeah, core set of nursing skills to rely on, rather than knowing that you weren't going to be a specialist in absolutely everything. But there was always something that I could do that maybe other nurses couldn't when I went onto a really specialist ward. Like if I went to medical and we got a surgical outlier, I was like, it's fine. I've got this. I've worked in surgical. And I remember being in cardiology one day, and we got a patient that was on TPN, and they were all like, oh my God, what do I do? I'm like, oh, you roll the bag and do that. And they're like, can you show us? And they were looking like, this is cool. Oh my God, she's crushing that bag. And I'm just like, have you not done this? Not for like 20 years. No. It's just, yeah. And you kind of got that, yes, I'm the most junior person in the room, but I know a thing from another ward that is mm-hmm. going to help me here. So my biggest advice for new nurses, and I give this advice to students as well, is that don't be afraid of being wrong or not knowing something because you think it's going to make you look stupid or like you don't know anything. You're brand new. You're all shiny and new. It's okay to still be learning. Nursing is a lifelong journey of learning, and it's trite, but it's very true. The only stupid question is the one that you don't ask, and pretending that you know when you don't is not good for you, not good for the patients. And being critical of your own learning and your own skill set, and being able to recognize what you need more support from or more knowledge on, and ask someone to help you with that, is the best thing that you can do. It doesn't make you stupid. It doesn't make you hopeless for not knowing something, even if you have to keep practicing it. It makes you self-aware and a safe practitioner to know that there are limits to what you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's particularly true in Poole, because we had to learn to be very assertive early on and say things like, I've never done that before. I'm not comfortable doing it, but can you show me?
Mm-hmm.
I find different hospitals will have a lot of different ideas about what should be a competency and what you can just learn sort of on the job by watching somebody else. Here in England, everything is a competency. So, mm-hmm. But no, there were a lot of things back home that I learned just by watching someone else do it on shift, and then having maybe an educator come and help me with it the first time I did it solo. And I learned so many good skills that way, like doing syringe drivers for palliative care patients, and how to remove PICC lines, how to troubleshoot a central line that's clogged, which is a skill that I still use in PACU now. And yeah, there's just so many different things to learn and so many different opportunities out there. So don't be afraid to go and get them. It doesn't make you silly to not know. Not everyone can know everything, and that's particularly true as a student.
Yeah, I love that. It's so true, because, you know, I think, yeah, we put so much pressure on ourselves as like new nurses to be like, oh no, we should know what to do, you know, like I'm gonna be a nurse now, I need to know how to look after my patients. But the reality is, like, we don't, you know. And as you said, it's like a lifelong learning career, and I think you know, we need to realize that we can take a step back and just learn every day and, you know, ask questions when we don't know something and just sort of make that, what was I going to say? Like, just make that like real thing, you know, like it's okay to not know things. I got my words mixed up, but you know what I'm trying to say.
Absolutely. But no, it's just, I learn something new every week at work because we have so many specialties, and I learn it from different people. Like, I learn it from brand new people that have worked there for 2 weeks because they have a different experience to me. I think our team in recovery in particular, they have so many different backgrounds. We all had a life before recovery, and that's where we get so much of our knowledge from. And it's just that, use that as well when you're on the wards. If someone worked in a different area before, you ask them about it, ask them about what skills they can teach you. And you'll often find people ask you about your placements, and you'll have been places that they have never been, and maybe you'll know something cool that they don't. And yeah, it doesn't matter that you're a grad, you can still be a critical thinker, you can still contribute to the conversation. You know, it's like my moment with my senior colleague. He's got at least 10 years experience on me, but he still, you know, found something that he valued about my experience and opinion. So yeah, don't let the years of experience and people's rankings put you off. Everybody's got something to offer.
Yeah, wonderful. Thanks, Danny. Now, what made you decide to move to the UK? And can you tell us a bit about the process of applying for jobs and, you know, the process of, you know, whether you had to get a different registration or whether APRA was good enough for the UK? And, yeah, just how was the whole process of finding everything?
So I was always sort of aware that nursing was a degree that you could travel with to an extent. And I've always wanted to travel, you know, poor little Australia, very far away from everything, very expensive to get anywhere. And I've just had no money for so long that I've just gone, I don't think travel is something for rich people that I'm never going to get to do. But it was like kind of an idea that I had that maybe one day I'd work somewhere. But I think I saw an ad on Facebook for the British Nursing Expo, where a bunch of hospitals from the NHS come to, like, I think it was Brisbane, Melbourne and Sydney to basically woo the Australian nurses into coming over, because they know that we have it really nice in Australia and that they really have to put in the effort to get us to come over. But that a lot of us are, you know, hungry for travel, for a new specialty, for experiencing a different health system, and they do have a lot to offer on that front. And so I went to this expo. I was still hunting for graduate jobs and I didn't have one yet, and part of me thought maybe this will cheer me up, like thinking about my future. And I was, my particular hospital was there, but there was like King's College in London was there as well, which they have their own TV show, and I thought, oh my god, that's so cool. And they were doing interviews on the day, and I was talking to all these people, and I suddenly realized that, you know, this wasn't something for the lofty and in the future. They were willing to hire me like right that second. And I did an interview for a couple of hospitals. I did it for King's College. I knew I probably didn't have any intention of actually living in South London, but I just wanted to know if they wanted me. Like, I think that was a bit of
a little confidence boost.
I got like an offer from them, and I was like, great, I'm not going to take it, but love that. Thank you. It's like, I added it to my list of considerations because I think my mother was a bit horrified when I said, you know, King's College, you know, from 24 Hours in A&E, the one where and she's like, is that the one where everyone is always getting stabbed? I don't think I want you living there. I don't tell her that everywhere in England, if you go into a park at night, there's a good possibility that there's something bad will happen. But she still thinks that it's lovely and quaint and, you know, I don't know, out of call the midwife. And the particular hospital that I now work at, it's a big university hospital, and they made a very good offer in the sense of like support and helping you to do your registration requirements. And most of the hospitals there were like that as well. There was, you know, ones from Scotland, ones from the north of England, from London and from the south. And I think a lot more of them do come out to Australia now. This is obviously pre-COVID when they were allowed to do that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the hospital that I'm at has a huge contingency of overseas nurses that come over from Australia, from the Philippines, from Canada, some from countries in the EU as well, and they're really well prepared for it. So the process of applying for jobs, you can apply directly to a trust. So that's what we call hospitals in the NHS. They're called which means mm-hmm. it's just a term that means they manage their own finances instead of being one that's like centrally controlled by something. They explained it to me once and I sort of was like, okay, that's cool. Great. But most big hospitals are called trusts.
Okay.
So like, for example, London is a good example. You have like, you know, the trust might be named like Barts Trust, but there's a few hospitals within that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like some of the big famous ones, like Guy's and St. Thomas's or St. Mary's or the Royal London, they'll all have a trust that sort of governs them, and there'll be a few hospitals in that one. Okay. A bit like we have like Metro South Health or Metro North Health in Queensland.
Mm-hmm.
And you can apply directly to those trusts and sort out your registration by yourself. That can be a very difficult and overwhelming task. My advice would probably be to apply to a trust that has positions specifically for overseas nurses, because they will help you out with the process. So basically, your ARPA registration, you've got to have it. You have to be registered in your own country, but they're going to the NMC, which is the Nursing and Midwifery Council in the UK. They're like the APRA of the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And they get you to do what's called the test of competence, which is how you get your registration. So there's two parts to it. There's a CBT, which is a written exam. It's mostly about, it's not clinical like a lot of people think with the NCLEX in the US. Mm-hmm. It's more it's like a common sense test almost. It's like about the GATT. Yeah, it's like the NMC code of conduct for nurses. Mm-hmm. And like your ethical and professional responsibilities. There are, however, some clinical questions in there, and mm-hmm. there are a certain number of medication questions that you must get all of them correct, but they won't tell you, like, it's not like there's a stack of them. They just kind of scatter them throughout the test. That's mm-hmm. the only like really nerve-wracking part where you're like, oh my God, did I get all the maths right? But yeah, so you have to get a certain percentage on the CBT and then a certain percentage of the, I think it was 100%, but I feel like it was previously 90 or something ridiculously high anyway. It's just like nursing school where you have to get all your med questions correct because they're important. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they're really easy ones too. It's like doing first year nursing quizzes all over again, but then, you know, you have that moment where you're like, oh my goodness, I'm so out of practice. If you pass that one, you apply for, you will be invited by the NMC to take the OSCE. And the OSCE you have to do in England at one of three universities, like Oxford, Brookes, Northampton, or Ulster, which is Northern Ireland, I think. I did it at Oxford, Brookes. That's why Oxford and I have a very traumatic connection. You go back there for like 6 months for fun because I'm just like, yeah, all I think about is going there to do my OSCE. This is why. So the OSCE, it's like a practical stations. It's called API. So it's like assessment, planning, implementation, and evaluation. So it's like doing a set of OBS and an assessment of a patient, using their National Early Warning Score chart, which is called the NEWS score. Mm-hmm. It's a bit like Between the Flags in New South Wales or the QAD score in Queensland.
Mm-hmm.
And then the I even forget what planning was, but implementation is like your drug round. You've got to do your drugs. And then evaluation is like writing a plan of care for the patient that you're discharging, sort of business. And then you get two clinical skills stations, and they're usually some basic stuff like basic life support, getting a sample of urine from a catheter, doing a fluid balance chart, doing, I got an intramuscular injection for mine. I failed my first OSCE because when I did the IM injection, I didn't say out loud that the skin that I was injecting into didn't have any bruises on it, because I thought that was common sense. No, you need to verbalize things that are common sense.
Yeah,
but that's why I would recommend going through a trust that has an overseas nurses program, because they will prepare you for the OSCE. It's not that it's inherently hard or things that you can't do or that you haven't been doing for years. It's that they are very specific and picky about how they want you to do it. They do it by the Royal Marsden Manual of Nursing, mm-hmm. and word for word from it. So going through a trust means that their education team can prepare you and you can do practices, and it's just a lot nicer. Also, because the OSCE is very expensive to take, some trusts will pay for you to do it. My trust and a few of the other ones around me, they'll pay for two attempts. If you fail twice, the third attempt you have to cough up for, because you're getting to be a little bit expensive. if you fail a section, you only have to repeat the section you failed. So I only had to go back to redo the IM skill.
Oh, and thank goodness.
You better believe that I said everything out loud in possibly what could have been construed as a condescending tone, because I was a little bit annoyed that I had to read to it. But no, it was, you get all dressed up in your uniform. Like, I work in theatre now, so I wear scrubs, but like the blue.
Yeah, NHS I don't know if dress, I like the uniform, to be honest.
It's like, it's very national. Like, staff nurse blue is like north to south. It's a whole thing. But I don't know. I think because it is quite iconic over here. You do feel a little bit proud getting dressed up in that uniform on the day and being like, oh yeah. Some places will make you start as a band two, which is a HCA, a bit like an AIN. HCAs have a slightly bigger scope of practice than AINs. They can do OBS. And some more basic things. They can be trained to do bloods and cannulation as well. But my trust and a lot of other trusts will start you as a band four, which is an associate practitioner. It's a little bit like being an EN, that you have to work under the supervision of a band five registered nurse. And then once you pass your OSCE, you'll become a band five, which is a staff nurse. So I was allowed to start working before I passed my OSCE, because it can take a couple of months sometimes. But it just means that you can earn and be part of your new hospital while you're waiting to pass.
That's interesting.
That's basically how you get your registration in the UK.
Yeah.
It sounds scary and it sounds like a lot of stuff, but having your hospital that you're working for, they tend to really help you get through it all, because obviously they want you and they want you to pass and get your registration. They're really invested in that. There's some paperwork things as well, like when you're still in Australia, you got to get a copy of your university transcript, and they want like an original, so I had to get my university to send it to them. There's a APRA has to send a form that's like a certificate to verify that you've been on the register. You have to get a doctor to sign a form that says that you are fit to practice. I had to go to my specialist that does my for endometriosis, and he has very terrible handwriting, and I'm just like, I really hope they're going to accept this, because I can barely read it. but they did.
Perfect. So, well, thank you for that.
Yeah,
it sounds a bit like hard, but then I suppose like it would sort of streamline. It would probably be hard now during COVID, but
it is.
You had to fly over there and do the OSCE and everything, so that's a bit extra.
Yeah, so basically I flew over to start my job and my life over there, and then just kind of went, gosh, hope I pass.
Yeah, you'd be thinking the whole time. Oh, that's interesting. What would you say is like the biggest difference between like the UK and the Australian healthcare system and nursing in general. Like, people were really interested about this and, like, mm-hmm. shift routines, I suppose,
yeah.
and what you prefer. And if you don't mind, like, talking about any differences in pay as well.
Mm-hmm. So, yes, full disclosure, UK nurses, our pay, it's not great. When you convert it from pounds to Australian dollars, I make about $20,000 less a year as an experienced nurse than I did as a newly qualified nurse in Queensland. Oh, wow. Queensland is probably the best paid state in Australia, so
yeah,
I like add a little less because, but yeah, but there's also big differences in cost of living here. Mm-hmm. If you work in London, you get paid slightly more because London is very expensive to live.
Yeah,
you get like a, it's like tax almost, you get a bit more money.
We're a lot like Australia too. We're also constantly trying to get better pay, and it's a big focus of our national union, so it's ongoing, but there is generally an agreement that yes, UK nurses do not get paid enough and we should definitely get paid more. But I honestly, because it's so cheap to go and travel as well, I haven't noticed that much. There's just some months where, you know, you really do have to budget and think about what it is you're doing. But mm-hmm. if you're smart with it, and, you know, you keep your cost of living sensible, it's very doable.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a bit worried about money, I'd probably advise trying to think about working somewhere outside of London, because London is incredibly expensive. And there's lots of things to do, and it's very easy to get, you know, caught up in the social mm-hmm. life of it. Not so much during COVID, but now that we're all allowed back outside and into the fun. Biggest difference, I guess, between UK and Australia is the population for me. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more people in the UK. The National Health Service has a lot more it needs to cover. Rural England and rural Australia are worlds apart. Both in the amount of services that we offer and the amount of people living in what we'd call rural mm-hmm. England, and even up to Scotland as well. So the NHS is quite stretched, and there's just a lot, there's a big waiting list sometimes in both inpatient and outpatient care. That's a story that we know in Australia as well. Mm-hmm. But I think the biggest thing is that our health system has been feeling the strain for a long time, and there is a lot of issues with short staffing, which is why we do really welcome overseas nurses, because we know that they are an absolutely vital part of the NHS. And just the idea of the NHS as well is what's different for me. Like, obviously our state health departments, they're state controlled, so we kind of, it finishes at the border.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the NHS is national. It's an institution. It's very iconic, and people line up to defend it and sort of ask us not to take it for granted, which is yeah. absolutely true. Like, GPs all come under the NHS here too, so you don't have to pay to go to a GP in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
It's all free, but that also means that, you know, it's a free service for everyone, so there's a lot more waiting time. Like, it's really hard to get in to see a GP here because mm-hmm. you're sharing with so many other people. So those services, I guess, are offered a lot more. Whereas there's things in Australia that we'd probably say some of them are publicly funded, like you get your bulk billing GPs, but if you can pay, you know, $70 to go see someone who's technically private, you'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
But private here is like going to a specialist, and you're paying a couple of £100 for a private GP appointment because there's free GPs everywhere. But yeah, I quite like the idea of the institution, like the whole NHS thing. It's like a big team and a big family. Like, there's trusts up in the north that I've never met anyone there, but, you know, I would absolutely stand by them. They're one of us, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And they're very welcoming of the overseas nurses. They make you part of the family because we're so needed. And there are a lot of challenges associated with the short staffing and that sort of thing. But I think given what we're working with, we really do turn up for each other. And there is that sense of teamwork, because what else are you going to do if you don't try and retain the staff that you have and, you know, make it worth it? No one's ever going to want to come to work ever again. And I think that's something that nurses all over the country do really well, is that we do a lot with quite a small amount, resources wise.
Mm.
And yeah, there's an ease to the Australian healthcare system that I sort of took for granted, like being able to go private with private health insurance if I wanted to. Mm-hmm. I'm someone that didn't have private health insurance when I went through my endometriosis surgeries, and it was very expensive, but here it would cost even more. I would not have enough money here to go private. I'd just have to wait it out in the NHS with everybody else.
Wow.
But there are also a lot of services that we didn't cover in public back home that the NHS will cover here.
So I guess there is a bit of pros and cons to it all, you know, like there's no healthcare system that's perfect. I'd love to chat to someone about the US healthcare system. That one.
Oh yeah. Interests I think UK lot. And Australia can all agree that it's like, hey, we're not perfect, but at least we're not them. like no one has to bankrupt themselves to get chemo in this country. Mm. That's a positive that I think we can all agree on.
Yeah. I remember I was watching a show, sorry. And, yeah, like they had to sell their house to pay for medical bills and live in like a caravan park. And I was like, what the hell? Like no one chooses to get sick. No. You know what I mean? I would think if I was living in the US, you would have to live a very healthy lifestyle to prevent any illnesses, honestly, because it'd be so expensive to get any care. Like I can't even imagine like all the people that, you know, that have received care for COVID over there and might not be able to afford it.
Exactly. It's just, and that kind of thing also just drives the kind of care you give as a provider as well, because if it's all monetized, there's just you're going to feel that pressure from above to deliver a business model and not just a clinical model.
Yeah, I feel like that's a lot with private hospitals here. Like I've got I've done placement in private and public hospitals, and I would never work in a private hospital just because I feel like in private it is very money driven. Like it's all like, you know, we want to provide like best customer service, and obviously for me that's building rapport, you know what I mean? It's a very different terminology, you know. Of course, like I want to provide really good care to all my patients, but I don't want to have to think of them as a customer and I want to get a tip from them, you know what I mean? Like
exactly.
It's very different. And I remember like a patient came in for an elective angio or something, and like in a private hospital when I was a student, and it was like waltzing them into a hotel room. I was like, follow me, I'll show you to your room. And I was like, oh my god, am I in a hospital or am I in a hotel? Like it's just very strange, the whole you know, differences in that. And I feel like you do kind of change your you know, persona to be like, you know, we want to make sure this is like the best experience for them. I don't know. Didn't sit too good with me. Like, I don't know, just felt weird.
For sure. I've only ever worked in public hospitals, so I've never had that experience. I've only ever been a patient in a private hospital. But I've been like a patient that has to be like, no, I don't want to stay overnight. I can't afford that.
Like, send me home.
Just give me my antiemetics and I'll go. I know I'm throwing up and you want to keep me for fluids, but I'll deal with it. It's fine.
Yeah. Like, I'll cannulate myself at home. Just give me a bag of fluids and I'll sort it out.
How much is that bag of fluids? Oh, actually, no. I'll just do water.
That's funny. So that's interesting about the differences and everything. Is there anything else you want to touch on before we chat more about PACU nursing?
So I guess shifts in the UK are a little bit different for sure. I know a lot of private hospitals and even public hospitals have switched towards that 12-hour shift model. It's fairly standard in the NHS that you work 12-hour shifts, that you work long days. Theatre is actually one of the few areas where we don't, but we tend to work 10-hour shifts. my department has only recently started transitioning to long days, and I the 12-hour shifts, honestly, I 12 doesn't seem that bad to me. When I first got here, I've been working like 8-hour shifts, and I was like, oh my god, 10 yeah. hours, that's insane. Like, I worked 10-hour nights sometimes when I was mm-hmm. in CCU, but it was just like, oh my god, 12-hour night, like, how do you do that? Yeah. But now it's just standard, and you're so busy that you'd think like, no, I need the extra 2 hours just to make it
catch up.
But yeah, there is a method to that madness, I think, because we are short-staffed. It just helps reduce a bit of error, I guess, because you're having less handovers on a 12-hour shift, then so less time for things clinically to get lost. Also, 12-hour shifts technically are designed to give staff more days off, so if people have a better work-life balance, they're more likely to stay in their job. That said, if you have a very busy department, a very busy shift, a 12-hour day can be extremely long and grueling. And if you're not getting your breaks, that's very difficult. My department is quite good at getting breaks, but that's just because of the ratio of nurses to patients. I guess on the wards, it's a lot more challenging, and that's true of any hospital.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's not typical to have 8-hour shifts, or if you did, they would be called short shifts. We also tend to do funny shifts, like we call them twilight shifts, which mm-hmm. is like from anywhere from about 3 or 4 in the afternoon until 1 a.m. to cover the busiest part of the crossover between day and night shift.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
A bit strange as well. Like, yeah, I wouldn't want to go home at like 1 a.m.
Yeah, we try not to do them very often because it's not the best time to be leaving the hospital, especially in winter. It's freezing.
Yeah.
We also have this thing called bank nursing, or NHSP as standard. Mm-hmm. It's like where you can pick up extra shifts in your department or any other department where you've got privileges, like where you have mm-hmm. experience. So yeah. Like I do it in recovery and in surgical wards. Some people do it in like A&E, I've gotten used to saying A&E instead of ED. Yeah.
What does it even stand for?
Accident and emergency.
Accident. I couldn't get what the A was.
We used to call it casualty, apparently, and now it's A&E.
Because I know in America they say the A&E or the ER and stuff. And
yeah, I'm they like to say what is ER. This? They're like, everything's a room in America. It's the ER or the OR, whereas we're like... No, it's OT. It's theatre.
Yeah.
We're old-fashioned.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's probably – those are the bigger differences. There's a lot more opportunities to pick up extra shifts because we need them, basically. Yeah. The whole country needs them. But that's a good experience for you. Like, if the pay's less, but you have more opportunities to pick up extra if that's what you want to do. And mm-hmm. you're not pressured into doing it. It's a voluntary thing. But yeah, there's shifts out there available for you to book if that's what you want to do.
Lovely. I'll become a workaholic.
I know I have.
So we've talked a little bit about PACU nursing, but what do you think you love the most and the least about this area, and any tips for someone starting in this area?
So the thing I love the most about PACU is the variety of cases. Like I mentioned before, it can be, you know, a local day case that's going home an hour later, or it can be a high care ICU patient with 5 drips and a central line and noradrenaline running. Mm. And I love getting to do both. Like, sometimes the day cases are a chance to catch your breath in between bigger cases. But then you know that you can't rest on your laurels either, because simple cases can become complicated.
Yeah.
I like that it's very assessment focused. You're very much doing that A to E assessment constantly. I like that, you know, I'm the one as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm the one doing that assessment. You know, the anaesthetist will leave me things that are prescribed, but they're basically like, here is the pathway. The things I have left, go forth. So, like, I've got my IV I can give, and it's like, it's my prescription. I'm the one judging and clinically evaluating my patient and saying, yeah, no, they need a bit more, or no, that's enough, that sort of thing. There's, for some cases, there are pathways where it's like, if the blood pressure is low, start this drug. Like, I can do it without getting the anaesthetist to come out and prescribe it. Obviously, I give them a nice courtesy call to say, hi, I'm starting the pathway now. But yes, oftentimes they can't come out of theater because they're in the next case. And so we, as critical care practitioners, to start to evaluate and say, well, no, they're not doing so well, let's start this pathway. And I think the thing that I didn't think I'd love, but that I have come to love, is that I work with a lot of the senior doctors more than I did on the ward, because obviously the FY1s, which is like the residents or the RMOs, and the senior house officers, they're the ones left out on the wards to do all the day-to-day work. Whereas in theatre, you typically, the most junior person in the room is a registrar, maybe a house officer, a really senior one, because they're in their specialty training. And so I work a lot with consultants, so they don't scare me anymore, because I've got banter and chat with them. It's like, you know how you were saying that, you know, you were quite nervous to call doctors when you first started.
Well, consultants, I'm too scared to call still.
I was scared to call the FY1s when I first started as well. But now I'm just like, I see an anesthetic consultant in the hallway and I'll be like, oh, hi, are you going to bring me one this time that's got this prescribed? And like, I'm sassing off at them, like, in a way that I'm like, who am I? This is insubordinate. But they love it because we've got that team spirit and that banter. And the patients, I think, they like that too. They like to see that we don't take ourselves too seriously, but and that we can communicate with each other and get what's done. And the consultants and the registrars in particular, they really do respect our opinions and our experience as recovery nurses. And I find that a lot. If you call them and you say, I'm having this problem, what do you think I should do? A lot of the time they'll say to me, well, what's your impression? What do you think's going on? And I might say, oh, I think they're a bit dry. I think they need a fluid bolus. And they go, yeah, I agree. Or sometimes I'll be like, yeah, that could be it. I reckon we go straight to starting this drug though. And you go, yep, sounds good, I'll do it. And there's just, it's a really good team. And I feel like maybe that's a bit of a difference between the UK and Australia too, that I didn't appreciate, is that there's a bit more rapport between the doctors and the nurses. And I don't know if that's just because it's come about of we have realized that we need each other to survive, because there's a lot of stress on the public health system. I love working with my registrars. They're my favorite people. And especially on night shift, where it's like you've got one covering everything, and you know, they'll come through the door and it'll be like, oh, it's you again, are you going to bring me some good ones tonight? And it's just, yeah, it's a good time. What I guess if I had to pick something I don't like about the area, it's that it's very easy for the theatre flow to be interrupted by the tiniest things. So like a disaster on the ward that I have no idea about backs up onto my beds. Like if the ward can't take them back, then recovery gets full, theatre can't come out, theatre can't keep operating, and suddenly everybody is very stressed and trying to figure out who's to blame for this. And it's like, well, it's not really anyone. It's just something that happens. And it's like, it's something that used to happen back home as well, but I was a student and I didn't really, you know.
Yeah, you don't realize.
It's not that I didn't care. I was a bit shielded from that. Yeah. Like there's so many people in clinical operations and bed management. They do such a fantastic job and I could never do their job. It's so difficult. It's not my favorite thing, that things that happen outside my department, outside my control and outside my scope of practice affect me being able to discharge my patient in a timely manner and get that patient what they need. Because recovery is not an ideal environment to stay long term. It's loud. It's can be a bit chaotic. It's for waking up, getting stable, and then off you go. So if you have to stay there for hours on end waiting for a ward bed, you'll start to notice some of the things that we lack, like food and a toilet Like, you can't get up and mobilize in recovery. You have to go on a bedpan, and people, they don't like that. And it's like, there's things that we are not equipped to provide because we're not a ward area, mm-hmm. that you'll start to notice the longer you're awake and the more you start to want to do things like call your family and read a magazine. And it's just, yeah. So when people are at that stage, they're able to go back to a ward area. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's just, it's stuff that's a bit above my pay grade, but that still affects me.
Yeah, definitely. And coming on to that, like, what do you think has been the worst complication you've come across in PACU?
I've had some doozies because I feel like I'm one of those people that just attracts a bit of
pain
on the patient. You know, everyone has that period of time where you're like, oh, am I the drama? Have I attracted this? And it's just like, no, everyone just has a bad run sometimes.
Yeah.
I think the worst is, I've probably got two. First one would be, I had a patient that had a local anesthetic and ended up in a full resus situation because they had a big complication that we didn't know about pre-op, had nothing to do with the surgery, and they got very, very unwell. I think it might've been a ruptured AAA sort of thing.
Oh dear.
And no way anyone could have known, but we had to deal with it in recovery.
Yeah.
I think I get a lot of patients having thoracic surgery mm-hmm. for like vats and lungs and that sort of thing. I've had a few times where patients have come out and I've not been able to ventilate them because they've had a big hemopneumothorax and they have it washed out, and sometimes they'll go straight down to intensive care because they're not safe to extubate.
Wow.
Those are some of the bigger complications that I've had that you have to really jump on. But recovery can sometimes be a lot of little things as well.
Yeah.
Like, you're an airway specialist and that airway is essential. It doesn't take much to tip it over. So, you know, if someone's not breathing, a laryngospasm, and you need to get in there and bag them. I think every recovery nurse isn't comfortable until their patient is talking, because that means their airway's patent and safe.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. It just makes me realize, it's just like, I've never had any theater placements, no PACU, no recovery, and I'm just like, oh, like, it's a whole different ball game, you know? Like, I'm so used to my patients like talking to me, you know?
Yeah.
It's very different, and just makes you realize like there's just so many different areas of nursing that, you know, nurses can explore. So it's really interesting.
It is, and it's so much fun in PACU. We're fun. Like,
yeah.
The team I worked on as a student as well back in Australia, they were awesome. They're so welcoming. And the team I work in here, like, they're the best. They've been my family while I've been over here.
Yeah.
And it's just, you need that because it's an area where you do rely a lot on teamwork and people to come and help you. It's a one-to-one ratio, but
mm-hmm.
sometimes you need more than one person because, you know, if you're holding open an airway, that's your priority. You can't touch anything else. You are there for that airway, and you need someone else to go and get the other things. It's a lot of fun, and yes, it can be scary and there can be big complications, but they don't happen that often, and mm-hmm. usually your day-to-day is pretty smooth, and it's little things that you'll catch, or one of your team members will catch before it becomes anything too disastrous. And you've got the doctors around as well, which is really good. You feel a bit safer knowing that they're just back in theater, and that if it really goes badly, you can go in there and drag them out.
Yeah. And just finishing on the PACU conversation, what would be your biggest tip for nurses starting in PACU?
Definitely, again, don't be afraid to ask questions and just get all the knowledge that you can. Learn the surgeries as well. A lot mm-hmm. of people think that learning the surgeries is just for the scrub nurses, but understanding what's happened to your patient inside tells you more about the assessment that you need to do post-operatively.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, there's a lot of charts and that sort of thing that you'll do for different specialties. And it's really boring to rote learn all of them. It's way better and way cooler to understand why you're doing something and be like, oh yeah, this person's had a AAA repair. I understand that I'm doing foot obs on them because they cross clamp the aorta and there's a risk that there's, you know, ischemia in the limbs. So that's why I'm doing it, rather than, oh, I have to remember to do this chart and this chart and this chart. So yeah, get to know your surgeries, get to know the patients that are coming through for them. And yeah, like I said, a lot of us in my team, we all had a life before recovery. That knowledge will be absolutely essential because there's so many different specialties that'll pass through your door. Mm-hmm. And being able to get other people's experiences, that will help you become a very good, well-rounded practitioner.
Wonderful. I love that. Thank you for that. And just finishing up, what's your advice for someone wanting to move to another country to work as a nurse? And there was also someone that was interested about moving from the UK to Australia. So I don't know if you have any advice about that, because it's a bit of a reverse on you, but just general moving advice as a nurse.
Definitely put some effort into researching the place you're going. The place that I have ended up living, I'd never been there before. My first time living there and arriving there was the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, get to know, what can you do for fun outside of work? It's like, where can you make friends? Because travel sometimes to that's exactly, where is the nearest airport? It's like, yeah, like, don't overlook, you know, a lot of people go straight for London, but there's a lot of cool cities around that are just as good and maybe a little bit cheaper. I don't live there, but I absolutely love Bristol. It is super cool and cheaper than London. And it's a bit like the Melbourne to Sydney. Mm-hmm. It's got a complex. It thinks it's like the hipster version of London, or London thinks it's the cool spot with all the touristy things, but secretly, you know, Bristol's got the best coffee and that kind of business.
Yeah.
There's like cities in the north as well. Scotland is beautiful. Manchester and Liverpool have got some really big hospitals as well with really good experiences. And I guess don't underestimate either. You will get lonely sometimes. You'll get a lot of FOMO about the fact that all your friends and family are back home. You will lose sleep over the fact that you're should be going to bed, but you want to be on the internet figuring out what's happening in Australia while everyone's waking up.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you've got to just get over that and go to bed, because otherwise you'll never sleep again.
Yeah.
Yeah, there will be moments where you sit there and go, oh my god, I'm freezing, it's the middle of winter and there's no Vegemite at the store, why did I do this? But I love England. It's a beautiful country. There's so many places locally that you can go and travel. You can get to the top of the country on the train in like 4.5 hours, which is unthinkable if you live in Australia and it's like a 10-hour drive to everywhere.
Yeah.
It's a great time. It's a great experience. It's something that even if deep down you hate it, there'll be something about it that you love, that you won't regret doing it. It's an experience. And I guess for someone going from the UK to Australia, hello to all your new paychecks and money. Enjoy it. I guess be prepared that there's a bigger culture change than you might think. Everybody thinks that the UK and Australia are so, you know, we're all kind of British.
Kind of the business. Queen rules us all.
The Queen rules all of us. But it's like, no, there are so many differences, even just in the language, like the local colloquialisms and that kind of thing. You will be misunderstood so many times because that means something very different in the UK or in Australia. And people will try and imitate your accent and it's not going to go well. They can't do it. They absolutely can't.
Well, I was going to say, your accent is, you know, how long have you been over there? Because you're definitely sounding very British.
I've been there 2.5 years, and every time I talk to people back home, they're like to me, oh my gosh, you're so British. And I'm like, mate, no, I'm not. But here, everyone's like to me, no, you're not British. You're definitely Australian. You say weird things. And I'm just like, yeah, okay. I'm a bit in between.
Yeah.
I'm from suburban Brisbane, so I don't have a really like strong like country Aussie.
I don't think I could even understand country Aussie accents, but I just think
it's like rural Scotland. You don't know what we're saying. I think from UK to Australia as well, a lot of people do agency, which is a good option because it can be quite tough getting jobs in a particular specialty if you don't have X amount of experience, which is obviously what a lot of us find with our own jobs. But I met a lot of people when I was in Poole that were UK nurses doing agency work, and they loved it because they got so much money and they could travel around a lot and work at a lot of different places. If you come to Queensland, you'll just be a bit culture shocked about the fact that you only have to have 4 patients on a day shift and 8 patients on a night shift. That's an experience.
Even less than 8 on some wards, like cardiology, because it's still considered medical, it's 8. But all the surgical wards, it's like 5 to 6. It's amazing.
Yeah, CCU, I used to have 3 on a night shift. I'd just be like, what is this?
Yeah, I know. Like, even 8 on cardiology is pretty good because, like,
most of the time, 5 on cardiology.
Yeah, like, there's no IV antis really overnight. Like, you might have, like, 1 or 2, maybe. And then you're literally just doing OBS and that's it. And then, like, weights in the morning and things like that. But otherwise, like, they're all independent. You don't need to help toilet anyone. No one buzzes. It's pretty good, but then when it's busy, it's busy.
That's one of those things in cardiology, when things go bad, they go bad very quickly and very badly, so you gotta be absolutely on it. But you saying that about the IVABs, I've just like repressed every memory of it being 4 a.m and me making 8 antibiotics for the 6 a.m ones.
There's like, one how did I do that? Oh, I know. It's ridiculous. One night, I don't know why, but I was on the PM, but the overnight nurse was just, she'd printed out all the labels that she needed to give all the antis because obviously she would need to do one at the start of her shift and then probably at 6 a.m. So she'd have to do like 2 for that patient for the night. And I was like, thank God I'm not working this shift, because literally every patient in her section had some IV antis overnight. It was ridiculous.
I know. It'd be like when I do the orthopedic ward, and it'd just be like, what is it? Kefiroxim and metronidazole for all. I remember one night on my 4th night shift in a row, I stabbed myself with the blunt fill needle aim for the vial, because I was so tired, my hand eye coordination was off, and I was like, oh, that woke me up, and I was like, it's a blunt fill, why is it bleeding so much? And then I just start again, obviously, because it was no longer sterile. You'll never miss that.
No. Well, thank you so much for giving up your time after a 12-hour shift, and it's like nearly 11 o'clock for you at night. So I really appreciate it, and I'm sure everyone will love this episode because we touch on so many interesting things. So I can't wait to share. So thank you, Danny.
Not a problem. Thanks so much for having me, and I hope you guys learned a bit about UK nursing and come join us. We want you.
Yes. Well, thank you so much. Bye.
No problem. Bye.